My name's Tony Travers, and I'm director of the Institute of Public Affairs and a professor in the Government Department, and I'm here just to chair this evening, really, which is, as the excellent slide in front of you, is really a book. It's an event surrounding a book which has just been launched, Post-Truth, The New War on Truth and How to Fight Back, and our speaker is Matthew D'Ancona. I just read a little bit of the excellent blurb on the back of the book, which says, "Welcome to the post-truth era, a time in which the art of the lie is shaking the very foundations of democracy. The Brexit vote, Donald Trump's victory, the rejection of climate change science, the vilification of immigrants, all have been based on the power to evoke feelings and not facts." And there's no question that for a topic that has been amazingly quick to appear in public discourse, I mean, a year plus really to get traction and to become so prevalent to make, I mean, I find myself using the term post-truth or fake news five times a day, you know, and normally it takes a bit longer for these terms to creep into my vocabulary. So, I hope. Anyway, I should also advertise the hashtag for the event at the bottom there, hashtag LSE D'Ancona. Just to say a couple words more about Matthew before we begin. As many of you will know, Matthew's been a political commentator in Britain for a number of years, has worked for the Sunday Telegraph and the Spectator, currently writes for the Evening Standard, The Guardian and the New York Times, amongst others. He's also written a number of other books, was here in fact before to launch one not that long ago, and has also written novels. Somebody writes both in the world of fact and real fiction. Not many people do that, except real fiction, you know what I mean, anyway, proper fiction. And I think it's fair to say that he's a dispassionate commentator from a particular view about conservatives and non-conservatives alike, and one of those people who can stand back from their own understanding and starting point of whatever in politics and give us a clear view about what's going on inside a particular, or in fact more than one, political party. Just one final thought in a review, which was partly about this book and partly about another one on an analogous subject. John Gray, who used to be a colleague here at the LSE, wrote, quote, "Talk of post-truth politics absolves liberals from responsibility for their defeats and failures, while sustaining and comforting the illusion that the supposed normality of the recent past can be retrieved if only they fight harder for their certainties." So there is an essence of a question for liberals and indeed for everybody else in a book of this kind and in the subject that we're about to hear about. Format for the evening, Matthew will talk for a little while about his book. I'll then ask one or two opening questions and then we'll open it up for a broader discussion to finish at some time between 7:45 and 8:00. There will then be an opportunity to buy a copy of the book and doubtless to be signed by the author outside. But I'll say more about that later. Ladies and gentlemen, Matthew D'Ancona.
Thank you all very much. Thank you, Tony. It's always a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for giving up your evening to come and listen to some possible real fictions or post-truths. I'll leave that to you to decide. I suppose the first thing I want to do is address a question that a lot of people have asked me since I started writing the book, but since it's come out even more, which is, surely this is nothing new. Many people, when they're confronted with the phenomenon of post-truth, respond that way, and it's not an absurd response at all. So let me try and give my answer to that. It's true. Human beings have been lying to one another since they could communicate. What about Watergate, Bill Clinton's impeachment, the Iraq dossiers, spin, and to go back a little bit further, Machiavelli's advice to the prince to be a great pretender and dissembler, Plato's noble lie, and so on. To all of which I readily say, yes, mendacity is as old as language itself, perhaps even older. Falsehood has always been a feature of the human condition, and you can tell a politician is lying because, well, you know the joke. But post-truth is something very different, and it's, I think, something new. The novelty is not to be found in the lies, but in our response to them. It's not about them, it's about us. Now, as many of you may know, last year the Oxford Dictionary selected post-truth as their word of the year, defining it as shorthand for, and I'm quoting, circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. And I think that gets right to the heart of the matter. And let me give you a couple of examples, fairly obvious ones, just to set the ball rolling. Start with last year's referendum. Aaron Banks, who, if you aren't aware of him, is the sharp-witted businessman who bankrolled UKIP and indeed, more importantly in this context, the Leave.eu campaign, that was the unofficial Leave campaign, was correct in his analysis of the referendum outcome. He said, the Remain campaign featured fact, 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 fact. It just doesn't work. You've got to connect with people emotionally. Now, those pressing for Britain's continued EU membership, on whose side I must confess I was, bombarded the public with statistics. Leaving would cost 950,000 UK jobs, the average wage would fall by £38 a week, each family would pay an average of £350 a year more on basic goods, £66 million invested by the EU countries, the UK would be at risk, the cost of leaving would be £4,300 per household, and so on and so on and so on. I really got to the Dr. Evil point of, why make trillions when you can make billions? It just lost in a miasma of numbers. And it became easy to caricature this torrent of indigestible data as no more than a series of arbitrary claims. Now, what the Brexiteers, in contrast, understood was the need for simplicity and emotional resonance. They constructed a narrative that would give visceral meaning to a decision that might otherwise have appeared technical and abstract. As Dominic Cummings, who was the campaign director of the official Vote Leave campaign, argued at the time, the case for departure had to be clear, but it also had to cleave to specific grievances of the public. Now, a message based upon the trade opportunities of Brexit, which was mooted originally, go global, which in a sense has been one of the messages of the government since the decision, might have been intellectually defensible, but Cummings understood that it wouldn't win votes in the referendum. And he referred to earlier research that he had done on Britain's potential membership of the euro, which revealed the potential traction of a pledge to take back control. And he was proved right. On the other side of the Atlantic, after considering a run at the presidency for several decades, Donald Trump intuited a similar shift in popular behaviour. He was not really a sympathetic character at any point during the campaign, let's be honest, but he communicated a brutal empathy to voters who were all too aware of his character flaws. He rooted his candidacy not in statistics or empiricism, or, God help us, meticulously acquired information, but in a sort of uninhibited talent for rage and impatience, a readiness to attribute blame. And I think he moulded language. The assertion that Trump was plain speaking, which was made very often by his champions, didn't mean, as it might have meant in the past, this man is speaking the truth. It meant this candidate is different and he might just be addressing my anxieties and hopes. So when Kellyanne Conway, who by the time she said it was a senior aide to the president, spoke famously of alternative facts, she captured perfectly this new epistemology. Because in the post-truth era, what used to be called reality is absolutely fungible. The point is not to determine the truth in the Enlightenment fashion by a process of rational evaluation, assessment, and conclusion. You choose your own reality as if from a buffet. And I don't think it's an accident that this has coincided with a massive rise in popularity of conspiracy theories, of pseudoscience, notably around vaccines and climate change, and most horrendously, Holocaust denial. Try Googling Holocaust denial or Googling, is the Holocaust true, and see what you come up with. It's quite frightening. Now, how has this come about? Briefly, the social basis of post-truth, I think, is the collapse of trust in traditional institutions. Everything else flows from this one poisonous source. Above all else, the financial crisis of 2008 took the global economy to the brink of meltdown, and was averted only by eye-wateringly huge state bailouts for the very banks that were responsible for the disastrous collapse. In this country, that kind of explosive event was followed by the humiliation of the political class in the 2009 parliamentary expenses scandal. You'll remember the duck house, the bath plug, the pornographic films. These were things that really resonated. Meanwhile, scandals in show business, especially the monstrous sexual crimes of Jimmy Savile, dragged the BBC and other institutions he'd been associated with through the mire. For my own trade, print journalism, the hacking controversy was no less a disaster, forcing the closure of the News of the World, the resignation of its former editor, Andy Coulson, as Number 10's Director of Communications, and Lord Leveson's sweeping inquiry into the conduct of the press. In other words, we live in an age of particular institutional fragility. Now, society's institutions have many functions, but they act as guardrails. They're bodies that incarnate the values of that society and its continuities. And to shine a bright light on their failures and their decadence, and in some cases their outright collapse, is intrinsically unsettling. But that's not all. What has happened, I think, is that post-truth has flourished in this context as the firewalls, if you like, and the antibodies, mixing metaphors, have weakened. When the putative guarantors of honesty falter, so does truth itself. So that's the first cause. Secondly, digital technology has become the all-important, primary, indispensable engine of the change. Now, in the early years of the online revolution, it was optimistically assumed by many, myself included, that the internet would inevitably smooth the path to sustainable cooperation and glorious pluralism. It was the John Lennon period, I call it, and I was at my most hippie-ish in those years. I really was. I look back at what I wrote about Web 2.0, and I still feel a warm glow about it, and I haven't given up on it entirely at all. But I think I certainly underestimated the other aspect, the other capacities of this technology, which was to foster balkanization and a general retreat into echo chambers. Obama put it very well in his farewell address. He said, "We become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there." So for all its wonders, the web has tended to amplify the shrill and to dismiss complexity. For many, perhaps most, it encourages confirmation bias rather than a quest for accurate disclosure, and this is the crucial point, I think. As the coder Eric S. Raymond famously predicted in a book early to this particular subject, the cathedral, as he called it, is yielding to the bazaar. And there are profits to be made from the production line of clickbait hoaxes, unscientific medical claims, crackpot theories, fictional sightings of UFOs or Jesus. The disincentives to publication are, to date, marginal, and the ease of production is enticing, to say the least. For those on social media, anonymity dramatically reduces accountability. The buzz of the hive sends the falsehood fizzing into cyberspace to do its work. Never has the old adage that a lie can travel halfway round the world while the truth is putting on its shoes seemed so timely. So in the consequent cacophony, the flow of information is increasingly dominated by peer-to-peer interaction rather than the imprimatur of the traditional press, and that's maybe no bad thing. But it also has been accompanied by a very important mechanical or technological changes, which is that we consume what we already like and shy away from the unfamiliar. The ultimate generator of novelty has also become the curator of hearsay, folklore, and prejudice. Now, the absolutely crucial point is that this is not a design flaw. It's not an unintended consequence. It's what the algorithms are meant to do. They're meant to connect us with the things we like or what we might like. They're fantastically responsive to personal taste and, so far, fantastically blind to veracity. The web is the definitive vector of post-truth precisely because it's indifferent to falsehood, honesty, and the difference between the two. And so far, there is no sign of it being corrected. This is why fake news has become such an issue, especially on Facebook. If you look at the most read hoax stories of 2016 in the States, amongst them were the following: the claim that Obama had banned the Pledge of Allegiance in schools, Pope Francis shocks world, endorses Donald Trump for president, a report that Trump was offering free one-way tickets to Africa and Mexico for those who want to leave America, and my favorite, ISIS leader calls for American Muslim voters to support Hillary Clinton. Now, these stories are obviously mad and ludicrous, but what's scary is that they commanded belief. Ipsos did a poll in December of more than 3,000 Americans, not a bad sample, which found that 75% of them who had seen fake news headlines of this kind had judged them to be accurate. So if digital technology is the hardware, post-truth is proving to be a mighty software. It's reduced political discourse to a kind of video game in which endless play on multiple levels is the sole point of the exercise. Conspiracy theories, pseudoscience, Holocaust denial, all of them are enjoying a new lease of life and an unprecedented circulation. So, having depressed you with all that, let me venture a few optimistic ideas. The first is to say that in the same way as I disagree with those who say that post-truth is nothing new, I disagree with those who say that the pendulum will swing back. I don't think there is such a thing as the pendulum in intellectual idea discourse or the advance of ideas. I don't think that we move back and forth from enlightenment to post-enlightenment and back. It doesn't work like that. Human beings don't oscillate. So we have to respond to the context in which we find ourselves, and we have to do so with vigour. The first part of the response, I think, should be what I call the scrutiny spectrum, which is a whole range of often prosaic measures, but which taken in aggregate can have an effect. I'm very heartened by the growth, even in the last 12 months, of the fact-checking industry. I think if you look back at the Brexit referendum, my trade probably was not doing a good job at auditing the claims that were being made by both sides in real time. In contrast, during the general election, there was a real-time effort to try and assess what claims were being made as they were being made and flag them up as wrong, misleading, false, and so on. And much more importantly, this is going on across the world in all sorts of forums. If you look at bodies like Full Fact, First Draft, and so on, these are fantastically important initiatives, and they deserve our support and the BBC's reality check. And this is really is a new phenomenon, and it's one to be absolutely applauded. There is more litigation going on. Cases against Facebook and Google, particularly on the continent, but I think it'll follow here. And above all, I think there is a growing understanding amongst politicians I talk to that digital literacy must be a compulsory subject from primary school upwards. Because if children are to live in this world, they can't just be citizen journalists, that phrase that acquired a vogue about 10 years ago. They're going to have to be citizen editors. They're going to have to be discerning and understand how to navigate their way through this totally new information ecology. Allied to that, on a different scale, is the whole question of what to do about the tech giants. And I think Watch this space is my advice. One of the oddities of our parliamentary system is that laws die with parliaments, but parliamentary select committee inquiries go on. And there's a select committee inquiry still underway under Damien Collins into fake news notionally, but actually rather more broadly the role of tech giants and information. And my understanding in private is that some of its recommendations are going to be pretty robust, and this is again happening across continental Europe. Now, obviously, as a journalist, I'm always in favour of self-regulation rather than government regulation. I think the last thing that we want out of this is a Ministry of Truth. But I do think that government has a role to play, which is to address this absolutely systematically. It will only be if the bombers are hovering over the tech giants that they will take action themselves. And I think that may happen in this country sooner than we perhaps expect. They've already, you'll have noticed, rather showily announced initiatives, sometimes in concert with fact-checking organisations, sometimes to do with their own algorithms and so on. It's amazing how far they've moved already from a position where they've said, oh, no, it's nothing to do with us. You know, we're just a platform, to a position where they are as close as they've ever been to admitting that they are, of course, what they are, which is publishers. So that is incredibly important and a moving story. On a more philosophical level, I think it's really important to accept that facts are not enough in the fight against post-truth. Let me explain what I mean by that. The obvious human reaction to this is to presume that post-truth will sort of tumble under the bombardment of data. But actually, some studies have been done on this, particularly by a very, very impressive academic called Brendan Nyhan at Dartmouth, who's identified what he calls the backfire effect, which is that, strangely enough, if you take someone who believes something sufficiently strongly and you produce compelling evidence to the contrary, it will reinforce their original idea. So examples of this was that the more information Obama produced proving that he'd been born in the USA, the more strongly the birther movement held its ground and acquired supporters, which is an extremely alarming phenomenon. Likewise, Sarah Palin's completely ungrounded claims that the Obamacare legislation would have instituted death panels proved entirely resistant to an absolutely clear, well-referenced, multi-layered campaign saying this really is not true. The more people said you're wrong, you're deluded to believe this, the more people dug in. So if we're to address this, we have to understand that facts need to be communicated in a new way that recognises emotional as well as rational imperatives. We need to embed statistics in part of in personally digestible narratives. We need to produce resonant stories so that truth has, as it were, a delivery system, an emotional delivery system that speaks to experience, memory, and hope, and wraps facts in stories that speak to the human condition. Now, I'm absolutely not talking about sacrificing veracity to theatricality, but what I am talking about is when a prime minister is asked about nurses going to food banks, that she says more than I've put a lot of money into the health service. That's a very crude example, but it does give you a sense of what I'm trying to talk about, which is that if people are to take this very, very scary populist environment we're talking about and extract some sense from it, they're going to have to deal with the emotional resonance that, as it were, the bad guys have managed to master. And I think, oddly enough, part of that is a call to the public, not to be children, but to growth and maturity. Imagine how odd it would be now to hear any politician saying, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. It wouldn't get past their focus groups, and yet it's my belief that voters don't like being infantilised, as they have been, and actually are rather impressed when politicians dare to be honest. And we must break the cycle of unattainable promises matched by unreasonable expectations and try and close, if you like, the gap that has existed between rhetoric and reality, because it simply breeds further disenchantment and distrust, which we've seen is the peat, the swamp from which post-truth emerges. But in the end, I wrote the book as a call to arms, because I don't think that there is a they that will come up with a pat answer to this. This is something that's going to require, I hesitate to use the word insurgency, because it gives the impression of rallies in the streets, which is not necessarily what I'm talking about. But I do believe that collaborative effort will have to be at the heart of this, because truth is discovered, not distributed. And in a case like this, passivity is not a neutral act. It's a decision. It's a decision to comply with that which exists, that which is happening, and which in this case is highly unsatisfactory, I think, to anyone who values the basic tenets of liberal democracy and society. I'll just close with one of my favourite quotations. You may be familiar with it, which is that when Benjamin Franklin left the framing in 1787, he was approached by a woman who said, "What manner of government have you bequeathed to us, Dr. Franklin?" And Franklin said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And that "if you can keep it," I think, should be tattooed on everyone's soul. Because "if you can keep it" is the difference between post-truth continuing and something better and more encouraging and more optimistic taking its place. Thank you very much.
Okay, now as I promised, I'm just going to open up the questioning with one or two of my own, chair's privilege, and then I promise I'll give everybody a chance to have their say, or at least as many as possible in the time of you to have your say. I suppose, just to begin, Matthew, the presumably most of us are confronted in our lives with the question of whether we want to choose to be confronted by ideas we don't agree with. Now, if you choose to be confronted, you might accidentally not know you're not being confronted with alternative ideas, but I guess many people sort of pride themselves that deep down they want to face ideas. Some people are argumentative, let's say. We all know people are argumentative, I think we do. So, in a sense, some people who are argumentative inevitably have to find people that they don't agree with in order to, you know, debate and sharpen their skills. So I suppose the question is the implication of this subject and what you've written about, that, in a sense, there are people out there, possibly people in the room, possibly some of them, who, in a sense, don't want to be confronted by. Is that the underlying issue, that there are people who don't want to be confronted by ideas that they don't agree with? And that comes up in universities from time to time as well, of course.
I think none of us want to be, at one level, confronted by ideas we're not familiar with or which challenge our preconceptions. I mean, what's certainly not new is the idea of inclination after all, party affiliation used to be practically inherited. And everyone knows that most readers of The Guardian tend to be left of centre, and readers of The Telegraph tend to be right of centre, and that choice is not accidental. So there's nothing new about that, and I don't want to. I think it's very important that people who are engaged in combat against post-truth don't idealise a kind of golden age where everyone was engaged in a personal Jeffersonian adversarialism, you know, a kind of scientific, a little laboratory of the soul where they went, "Oh, I don't know about that, and maybe that and this, and oh, I don't know." That, of course, is not how people took their decisions. I think what's happened, and I do think technology has played a massive role in this, is that we're being, if as it were, there are two aspects to the human soul. One is that which is curious and exploratory, and fits into a world that is becoming more porous, more mobile, more commingled, where we are endlessly meeting what used to be called the other. That there's that suits very well the Enlightenment model, and then there is the opposite, which huddles in tribes and in cantons and in stockades, and digital technology as it exists at the moment is vigorously and in some cases violently encouraging the latter tendency. It is encouraging people to believe more of what they think already. It is encouraging people to form huddles. And one thing I haven't mentioned, and in a way it's a whole other discussion, is that there's no doubt that there are people who are scraping data off our social media and using it to malign purpose in order to steer us in a particular direction. Now, that's a whole other issue, because your question was about our inclinations. Mm-hmm. But I do think we need to be aware that, as it were, that tendency not to confront that which challenges us is being actively encouraged by the things which provide most, you know, the machines in our pocket. Because we, you know, each of us now has what amounts to is called a phone, but is actually a computer that has a greater power than NASA's mission control during the moon landings, in our pocket, which feeds us with a constant supply of information that is tailored to our geographical location, our political dispositions, our sexuality, everything about us that is individual. And in some respects, that's a good thing. But in terms of creating a society that is capable of dealing with difference and diversity and above all pluralism, it's not so hot.
And moving on, then, I mean, you mentioned in the book, and you mentioned just now, sort of pseudoscience, sort of National Enquirer, yes, almost sort of, you know, used to exist in that, but pseudoscience, and particularly an issue such as climate change denial, or denial of things that are broadly, I think, by science seen as factual. And yet I'm assuming that people who are prepared to go down that street and are prepared to, however accidentally or purposefully, find themselves believing things they want to believe in that way, also separate out other bits of science they do totally under. They take exactly the opposite view about. So I'm, you know, it's an old way of putting it, but they probably want to go on aeroplanes with trained pilots and meet doctors who are good at what they do. And oddly, they can draw the line there. So how is it that, what is it, is there any way of classifying the things that we can always get right, like having proper pilots and doctors, versus the things we choose, or some, it would apparently be, people's can choose which science to go with?
Well, I think there are different examples. I mean, I think climate change is a tricky one, because although it's quite obvious what is happening, and the scientific consensus is overwhelming, because it involves complex issues and discussions about not only climate but geography, population, and so on, it's very easy for people to take what might be called perverse positions. And also it involves time, because people ultimately, if they're told in 50 years' time this will be the case, that part of them which is responsible and thinks of their children and grandchildren thinks, well, better do something about that. Maybe I should put that can into that recycling bin. But the other part thinks, bollocks to that, you know, I mean, come on, life's too short, I'll be dead by then, what's it got to do with me? And there is, I think, on the climate change science, a particularly interesting example, because I think the media, and I count myself, when I've been in editing positions, partly to blame in this, has been guilty of what King's Aim is called pernicious neutrality, which is we like a row. And so you have 99% of scientists saying that this is a single climate change, and 1% of people saying, no, there isn't. And so what you do is you have a debate between Mr. 99% and Mrs. 1%, or the other way around. And you present it as if it was a court case. Now, of course, that's not how science works. And I think that the mediation of science is a really important issue in all of this. And I think, as I said, there are great lessons for the media. The other example, though, which rather fascinates me is vaccination. Because, of course, vaccination is something that affects people in a very immediate sense, because the key issues have been about the vaccination of children and MMR in particular, and the relationship with autism even more particularly. And here you've seen, I think, in its most pure form, the combat between science and what Jenny McCarthy in America, if you don't know who she is, she's a TV star, a former model. And she has a son called Evan who's autistic, and she appeared on Oprah some years ago and said that the MMR gives you autism. And when confronted with the proposition that no scientist other than the Strukoff Wakefield said this was true, she said, well, my expertise is the University of Google. Now, the University of Google versus science is actually a very, very powerful battle, because science has on its side the scientific method, the scientific revolution, the scientific institutions, the academy. Google has on its side everyone, because everyone uses Google. And so although McCarthy was pilloried for this, and in my view rightly so, she got a lot of traction, and a lot of people after that broadcast stopped having their children vaccinated. And what's fascinating is that although all of the things she said and all of the things that Wakefield said have been systematically discredited, he's just had a film out called Vaxxed. It came out last year, and it is available on iTunes, and it was in the top 10 for a while. So that tells you how adhesive these claims are, because they speak emotionally. They say, if you give this vaccination to your child, you may as well be condemning them to a life of autism. And that's a very powerful claim, even if it is rubbish. And that I think is where science has a particular locus in all of this that sometimes gets overlooked in all the political discourse.
One final one for me, then I will stop. This takes us into the world of sort of more traditional politics, and the issue that you raised about earlier on about, in a sense, trying to differentiate between traditional political, how should I put it, you know, care with the, careful presentation of the facts, and fake news. Now, I can see there clearly is a difference between manufactured falsehood purporting to be real, in the sense you've just touched on that, but there are things politicians do, are there not, which are so, I mean, you can draw a line between them, but the difference between what they say sometimes and fake news is so tenuously difficult to, I mean, you can theoretically describe them in different ways, but actually, in the end, the difference between I was right, I believe what I said then, and I believe what I say now, that was true then, this is true now, when the first then turns out to be wrong or a lie, it's very hard to differ. I mean, I know you can, theoretically, it's different from fake made-up stuff, but let me just take a broad issue to do with British public policy, one that I obsess about, so forgive me, which is this, that the whole British political class broadly is signed up to shrinking the size of the state. Mm-hmm. To a much, with a public spending total broadly the size of America, you know, a 36, 37, 38% state. And yet, purporting still that we can have all the welfare benefits and trains and all the great stuff of a 56% economy in Europe. And that's a kind of big cross-political affectation, let's use a kind word. Now, how does that differ from that sort of effective collective decision to pretend something that can happen when it can't? How does that vary really from the stuff that's made up?
Well, it doesn't, and in fact, it's a if you like, it's an urtext for post-truth, what you describe, okay. Because you know the British conundrum, which you describe much more eloquently than I could, which is basically that we're told on the one hand that we can be an Anglo-Saxon economy with low tax, but we can also have continental standards of public services, is obviously the problem, really, cap P. And I think one of the most interesting things in this recent election is that the public may be beginning to rumble that. Because whatever else one says about Corbyn mania, he made no attempt to disguise his intentions to raise taxes on the higher earning and to raise corporation tax. Now, he might not agree with that as a economic policy, but you know, there was a kind of honesty there, which was new. So I thought that was very interesting. On just briefly on fake news, I've actually reached the point where I think fake news may have to be dropped as a term, because it's become everything. I mean, I don't agree with something. I don't agree with really is fake news, and its use on Twitter is absolutely, well, it's very entertaining, but perhaps not necessarily useful. I mean, the minute that it was very interesting the way that Trump annexed it so quickly. That he, again, this shows that Trump is not to be underestimated, that he saw that fake news was so crucial to his own victory that he did what I believe psychologists call mirroring, which is immediately to call all his critics fake news. And his tweets all often include this, you know, CNN, New York Times, fake news, always capitalized. Fascinating. The uppercase is very interesting. And particularly if it's late at night. And I draw no conclusions from this, but I'm kind of getting to the point where I wonder whether fake news has been debased into meaninglessness.
Okay, very good. Right, lots of hands already. Right, very good. Let's start with the couple at the back there. We'll move around, but there's two or three together. We'll move down the audience, don't worry. So let's take two or three together in the back there, yeah.
Yeah.
One, two, three.
Can I ask a question about self-regulation in relation to post-truth? So I work in the architecture business, designing fire escapes. Back when I started, it was regulated by building control, and products that were combustible remain combustible. But now, in this post-truth era of self-regulation, in which building control is no longer run by the council, but is run as a profit basis, excuse me, what has happened is products that are not combustible are regarded as of being of limited combustibility and are used all over the place. And for me, self-regulation and post-truth go hand in hand, and that is a big part of the problem. Can you address that?
Okay, well, that's a serious matter, topical twice. So take the next man in front and then one. Yeah. I see how many hands are there. Yeah, you know, yes, one there. Right. Yeah. Take that one and then next door.
Yes, indeed.
Scott.
Yeah, thank you very much. I do have a friend who gets very, very uneasy when conspiracy theories are mentioned, because he was born in December of 1963, and his two given names are Lee Harvey. And I mean, that's a classic example of really, frankly, massive nonsense written. It's all a load of rubbish. The reality was worked out within a couple of hours. My question is, in regards to dealing with this and the fight back, do you find your media contacts, your colleagues, how are they reacting to the need to fight back? One example I would suggest is in relation to Guardian staff, how willing, for instance, they would be to tackle awkward facts like, for instance, the Rotherham and Rochdale business, which another newspaper covered. Thank you.
Okay, and one next door, yeah.
So I have two questions, quick questions. So one question would be, where do you see the future of post-truth? to be in the coming years, and considering the election, supposing Donald Trump is going to stand for re-election in the next election, do you think in terms of rhetoric we're going to see anything, any changes? Secondly, do you think there's a way we can hold politicians, you know, accountable with respect to how to fight back, in the sense that we can actually fact-check them and hold them accountable when, you know, they advocate for, you know, fake news?
I mean, it's an interesting question, the latter one, isn't it? Because newspapers themselves are capable of occasionally straying from the path of righteousness, but still.
It has been known, yes.
Yeah, go on, anyway. Three good questions.
Well, there are three excellent questions. And I thought the point the gentleman made about self-regulation in architecture was humbling and fascinating. And indeed, I wrote after Grenfell that I thought the Conservative Party would have to completely rethink its approach to deregulation, which had become ideological and rather than practical. The notion that deregulation is in some sense a good in itself, I think, rather than sometimes desirable, is very dangerous. And indeed, in this case, may well have been I think it obviously was the cause of horrendous loss of life and limb. Forgive me if I make a slight distinction between that and the regulation of the press and of tech giants, where perhaps the they're not quite comparing apples and pears. I mean, I tried to in my remarks to phrase it as carefully as I could, which was my preference as a journalist, as a writer, as a tweeter, is obviously always going to be towards self-regulation, because I don't want a ministry of truth. I think that the last thing we need is some sort of government body that said this is true and this isn't. But I'm a great fan of Damien Collins and his committee, and I think that it hasn't been covered enough, and I think that there are going to be some very interesting conclusions drawn from that which will shake up the tech giants. I notice you may have seen today that the EU has taken a really big pot shot at Google, not related to post-truth specifically, but the party's over for the tech giants. That's what I'm really trying to say. And there's some grounds for optimism. Now, whether that ends up with a huge lattice work of legal constriction and regulation, I don't know, and I suspect it will differ from country to country. But what I think has happened in the last year is that the tech giants have realised that in order to preserve their revenue streams, they're going to have to clean up their act a bit. And actually, I think that's more important than regulation of the print media, in the sense that I think the print media needs to settle this absurdly postponed question of its regulation. But in terms of the global information environment, it's the tech giants that matter. On conspiracy theories, I think what's very interesting about what's happened in the last 10 years or so is your friend who was called Lee Harvey in the immediate aftermath of the Dallas shooting, that would have been regarded as a very, so to speak, a somewhat exceptional event. And conspiracy theories at that point, Robert Hofstadter wrote a very famous essay about conspiracy theories in, I think, 64, when in which he said basically that these were theories at the margins and that they were very dangerous, but that they could be handled. What's it fascinating about conspiracy theories is that they've moved front and centre. And I think one of the appeals they have to people, other than the fact that they are often extremely entertaining, is that and they involve 6-foot-tall lizards and you know, the Illuminati and David Icke talking for 12 hours at a time. Not so sure about that one. But they impose order or apparent order upon a cruel and arbitrary universe. And in a world of hectic change and pulverizing change in many cases. I think that they offer a kind of odd comfort, that because they at least explain why these bad things are happening.
In place of religion, perhaps?
Well, there is a religious dimension to it, a cultic dimension to it. Mm. And if you look at the way in which conspiracy theorists interact, it's extraordinary to see that there really are people who quite seriously believe, and you can look it up, have gone back to flat earthing. It's become really, really quite popular. And now the fact that a lot of them are also Holocaust deniers may not surprise you, but it is extraordinary that there's a kind of cluster of people, but their influence is not confined to cranks. That's what I would really say. Do they have an impact upon the media? I'm not sure they do, really. I think that the extent to which the Express ran with the Diana nonsense was part of its long and sad decline. It's interesting what you talked about. You mentioned my colleagues on the Guardian and Rochdale and so on. I think that's if you forgive me, I think it's a slightly different point. There are questions about whether, on the one hand, political correctness, and on the other hand, extremism have caught between the right-wing extremism have sort of caught between them the whole range of issues and made it impossible to talk about them sensibly. I like to think that the Guardian has a wide range of voices, not least because, you know, I broadly write from a centre-right position, so does Simon Jenkins. So I like to think that it's a fairly broad church, but that's for others to judge. I'm obviously party pre, but I do think you know that your implicit point is a good one, which is we must never shy away from writing about the truth. To put it another way, if we start on the basis that our priority is never to cause offence, we may as well not get up in the morning. That would be my answer to that. The future of post-truth, wow, well, I mean, that's a... If I say it's up to you, I hope that's not taken facetiously, but I kind of mean it. The purpose of the book, really, was to say that don't rely on anyone else to do this for you. I'm heartened by the impeach Trump movement. I think it's terrific, and its breadth and width and apparent sleeplessness, the times of night that they tweet, extraordinary. But I think that there are signs of people not putting up with this, and this I like very much. But what I do believe, and this is why the Franklin quote is so dear to me, is that this won't go away of its own accord. And if we simply complain about it, it will metastasize and mutate. By the way, I don't think for a minute that the phenomena I'm describing are necessarily confined to the right. They have been so far, primarily, but I don't think there's any particular reason why a post-truth left-wing populism shouldn't arise somewhere in the world. And I'm not speaking about Corbyn particularly. I don't think Corbyn, one can object to on many grounds, but I don't think he's fallen into the post-truth trap yet.
Okay, right now. Let's take a question on the front row here, and then behind you, and then I'll come back to you, I promise, and then one in here. So one, two, three.
Just perhaps linking to your last point, you seem to have identified the root cause of post-truth phenomenon with a crisis of institutions. Is it perhaps also a crisis of identities? It seems perhaps superficially to be also associated with a particular demography, at least as far as populism is concerned. Thank you.
Okay, and then there's the one behind us, and then
thank you. Would education in school of politics and civics and the political process help the fight back?
And then three or four in on the front. Well, we'll take two more. Are you there? Did you?
Okay. So obviously you pointed to Brexit as one of the main case studies for post-truth. Would you say that this movement of post-truth has or is in the process of undermining British politics, as in the credibility.
And yes, one, just come down one in front. I thought you did.
With the exception of perhaps the Hillsborough inquiry, I think a great many people don't have much faith in public inquiries, and least of all in select committees. For quite a few years, people have been complaining about beheading videos on YouTube, and that's not really got anywhere with the tech giants. So I'm interested why you think now this will change.
I'll start with that, because it's an excellent question. I mean, select committee reports, you're quite right, are often pretty bland fare. Often they start off with good intentions and end up being, you know, fairly vanilla. The reason I say this is simply because I've seen some things that are proposed, and without they're not in final form yet, because obviously the government was only just formed, you know, yesterday. So Parliament has kind of been in this absurd situation until then. And I can't sit here and offer you a guarantee that what finally comes out of Mr. Collins's committee report is going to be a kind of silver bullet, magic bullet. But I do think that it's going to have a bit more grit than some of the others, and I think it will recommend some fairly stringent licensing of the tech giants. Now, whether a government, assuming by the time it reports this government still exists, by the way, which is by no means for certain, I'm serious about that, whether this government has the power to do anything so aggressive, I do wonder. Which is one of the many reasons I'm in favour of a second election. On the question of Brexit going on, has it led us into post-truth politics? Well, it certainly helped. I can't recall a more debased debate on a serious subject in 25 years of reporting. It was a disgrace. And, by the way, that's the media's fault as much as the politicians. But one of the problems was, just with a brief diversion, I talked a lot about emotional resonance and the need to wrap facts in emotional resonance, and I kicked the Remain campaign for not doing that. But one of the problems is that the EU institutions, unlike on the continent, don't really have much emotional resonance in this country. And I think that the problem that Remain faced was that Leave had all of these bogeyman arguments, you know, as well as the complete lie that 350 million quid a week was going to be spent on the NHS. Well, we'll see about that. Might be spent on the DUP, but not necessarily on the NHS. But also some very, very, very pernicious rhetoric on immigration. I would have liked, this is just a personal point, I would have liked to have seen a genuine and heartfelt defence of the pluralist society that Britain has become. I really would have liked to have seen that. Whether it would have won or not is another issue, and I'm sure that if Banks or Farage or any of those lovely people were here today, they would accuse me of being a metropolitan liberal elitist. But that's my belief, which is that there was an emotional case, but it wasn't to do with the EU institutions, and so it was a hard one. So yes, in answer to your question, the Brexit debate has done enormous damage. On education, well, you'll have only mentioned digital literacy, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think that I think education, school education, is in trouble at the moment, actually, which is that certainly pre-16, it's based far too much on a tick-box approach to making points in certain ways and marking schemes. And teenagers I talk to tell me that you know, they're given marking schemes as a way of preparing for GCSEs, and everything is geared around that. And the idea of preparing young people to think seems to me to have become subsidiary at best, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a civic disaster. I'd like to see children taught how to handle information in a modern world, to be prepared for, if half of them are indeed going to go on to university, life in the academy, but not just for that, for life as citizens. So absolutely, you know, 100% yes answer to that. Very interesting question from the lady in front row about the role of identities in and I think you're right that identities have had a profound role. There's a brilliant book by Iris Russell Hochschild about the American right in Louisiana, which looks at this and talks about what she calls the deep story of those who felt left behind. And I think that it's one of the most compelling accounts of a sort of micro study of what then became post-truth. So yes, but as I said, I think that thus far the identities that have been involved in this have been predominantly lower income white people who felt that they've somehow been left out of the narrative. But there's no intrinsic reason why that should always be the case. If post-truth is a software, it can work in all sorts of contexts. This is just the first act of the saga, as it were, has been in those arenas, worryingly so.
Okay. Now, guy in the middle there has had his hand up a while. I'll take one or two from the middle and come over to this side of the audience, and then chap there and the woman back there. Cool. You're on.
Visiting Brexit once more. One of the things I wonder about is there, do you think, a variation in the willingness to use everything that we know about the power of emotion, imagery, and narratives in order to make our arguments, particularly thinking about, are the metropolitan liberal elite that you referred to too squeamish to do this? And how it relates to Brexit, I don't know if you saw the advertising agency on the Remain side was so fed up that it released the unapproved concepts, and they are very emotive. There's not a statistic in there. There's babies. There's hand grenades.
Right.
That's a very interesting question.
Sharp one. Yep, and then one here, and then the woman further back. Yeah, you're on.
Yes, you're first. You mentioned how the tech giants, as you call them, have moved from their position of not being taking any responsibility, shall we say. But they've moved somewhat away from that. And you hinted at how there's perhaps working with fact-checking organisations and so on. Are you able to expand on that a bit more, if you know of things that are being planned?
And then further back.
Thank you. My question is going to be about experts. And I'm going to start from Brexit, because then you had a lot of articles following the result in which experts were saying we have failed the population. Closer, okay. In which experts were saying we have failed the population because we have failed informing them of what is really at stake. So it was a failure of communication. And this would fit in well with what you were saying about experts focusing on facts and not being able to communicate emotionally, on an emotional level, what they are trying to say. But I was wondering if you regard experts as being responsible of just delivering facts and delivering them better, perhaps, if they fit them into a narrative, or as a category who is suffering from a lack of trust, just like the political category, because there was also talk about experts from acronym institutions such as this one, which, you know, are just foreign in terms of interest to what the population's interests are. So there seems to be this kind of animosity towards experts, and I was wondering whether you see this as part of the failure as well.
And in fact, in fairness to those critics of experts, you know, it would be easy to observe that sometimes experts, strangely, their expertise leads them to the view they hold, if you see what I mean. I'm not saying that's ever true in academic world, obviously, but in general, there is a risk that it's sort of oddly...
Confirmation bias.
Exactly, yeah. Confirmation bias. That's it. So take those three.
Of course. Right, well... the whole question about Brexit, I mean, I really hope that they would be more emotional. And I suppose part of what I've been trying to do in the last year, even before writing the book, was to borrow the hard, soft Brexit distinction, encourage hard liberalism, which is a liberalism that is not afraid to speak its name. I'm not sure that it's just a squeamishness on the part of the metropolitan liberal elite, or a kind of, you know, that they wrap themselves in kale and hide under stones. I think it's simply a way of doing things. And an assumption, perhaps, about the way things have been, because the fact is that the centrism has been dominant for quite a while. I mean, essentially since the fall of Thatcher to round about now, centrism was where everyone. It might not always have been how everything worked out, and austerity has taken a terrible toll. But there were a group of centrist assumptions that held sway throughout the Blair Brown coalition years, and I think that's now gone. And what does concern me in all this talk about splitting the Labour Party and so on, and kind of just giving in to the populist surge is there is very little fight back. And so I endorse the spirit of your question, which is that I do want liberals to be less timid and to be less frightened about defending their point of view. And Tony quoted from John Graves, a great friend of mine, and therefore I'm not remotely squeamish about saying that I totally disagree with him. I mean, he's been saying that the Enlightenment is dead for about 20 years, and I don't think it is. Sorry. It works for me, and I think it works for a lot of people. And I also think that the pluralism that it advocates is absolutely the only way in a commingled world of the kind that we're living in and the kind that we're about to enter, in which will be work at a speed that makes this look like a Miss Marple episode. It is the only method that suggests itself. Now, does that mean we all have to sort of stop at J.S. Mill account and so on? No, of course not. But the idea that Enlightenment is dead and we're now in the middle of a dark ages, I won't have that. I mean, you know, accept that if you will, John, but I won't. Bless him.
Tech giants.
tech giants, yes. At the moment, they're on the naughty step. And they've come out and said a little bit about a little bit. So Zuckerberg has said, you know, we might flag up some disputed things. And Google has spent some money on various fact-checking organizations. It's doing collaborative things and using that terrible verb partnering, which is always a bad sign. You can tell when someone says they're partnering that actually they're not going to do anything. And I think Snapchat has introduced certain codes on its Discover channel, and so on and so on and so on. These are first baby steps off the naughty step, to mix metaphors again. But really, until there is a bloody big row about the content of algorithms, this thing won't really even have started. So, I think watch this space. And that's why I think the bombers of government regulation are going to have to circle over them before they'll really start to move, or at least of litigation. Lady's question about experts is a very good question. I mean, experts came in for a fearful kicking in the last 12 months. Michael Gove, of course, famous quote, and he maintains that he was only referring to organisations with acronyms. I'm not quite sure why that makes it better, but anyway. I tend to look at this in a positive way, which is I don't think experts should be flagellating themselves about this, but it's more a way of... I was at the OECD this morning, and, you know, to their credit, this is an organisation that, that has, you know, is a sort of the expert, the most expert of experts, right, in its expertise. You know, you can't get much more expertish than that. But, you know, fair play. They're addressing this, and they're trying to think of ways of personalising for the first time statistics that they've always sent out in the most, you know, arcane and PowerPointed way you could possibly have a nightmare about. And I think that that's admirable. I think that it requires cooperation between media and experts. I think that there are all sorts of ways of collaborating on this. But as Tony said, you know, you don't get into a plane and hold a vote on who's going to fly the plane. And after Grenfell, the word expert suddenly became quite popular again, I noticed. So I don't think that the kind of the cull of experts that was implicit in 2016 is going to happen, should or will it. Just to take one very, very small example. There's a technique which is being used by doctors in America called motivation interviewing. And it might sound terribly psychobabble-ish, but what's interesting about it is it tries to look at pathologies in the patient in a way that addresses the whole behaviour, background, and sentiments of the patient as well as just the symptoms. So what you are seeing is not just a transaction of information. Impersonal doctor hears that the patient is feeling ill, has a sore leg, ear has fallen off, whatever it is, but talks generally about the impulses that have led the patient to this point. Now, of course, what's really interesting about this is it takes longer. So everybody hates it in the health industry because it means that physicians are spending longer with patients, which, as you can imagine, is a bad thing. But actually, I think there's a lot to be said for it. It's inspired by 12-step programs, and I think that it may well have. It's one of those tiny little ideas that needs to be, you know, cupped in the hand to see whether anything comes out of it, because that idea of expert and consumer of information being bonded by a slightly different relationship to the rather dry and arid ones they have now interests me enormously.
Right, in the middle there, and then further out. So, lady in the middle, and then one, two, three. So, yeah. Go for it.
Hello. I was wondering what you think about the idea that maybe as much as a war on truth, it's a war on complexity. Because going back to the what you said much earlier about the press loves to kind of get one guy who thinks, who maybe speaks for 99% of the scientific population, and somebody else who's speaking for 1%, and pitch them against each other. But the truth normally is kind of a bit of column A and a bit of column B. And often what experts can't give you is one simple, and what clickbait won't give you is one simple piece of information, whether it's true or not. How can we combat that, maybe?
Yes, risk could be a very good example of how hard it is to get these things precise. Risk is the best one. Yeah.
Hello there. So on the subject of experts partnering up, the subject of data being portrayed more creatively, I'm wondering whether that applies to the press and journalism itself, whether they are able or would want to partner up and collaborate, because I kind of like the idea of it, but that would just render them biased, wouldn't it? If you take, I don't know, an editorial section and partner up with a department or a discipline or whatever, there goes your veracity. So what's the scope?
Do you mean partner up with a fact-checker or with an interest of some kind?
Anything, a fact-checker or expression of data or psychoanalysis or other sections of society which might be able to help the journalistic message.
Okay. Very good. And there was a gentleman further along there.
When it comes to working with an emotional narrative, do you think it's a level playing field between truth and post-truth? because when you engage with exaggeration or alternative facts, there's more of a license to explore the horrific or the awesome. So do you think this is a level playing field?
Right, three more good ones. Okay, off we go.
Complexity, hugely important element in all this, and I agree it is a war on complexity as well as on truth. That was one of the reasons that I talked at the end about not infantilising the public and having honesty. And in some respects, I think this is the most difficult step, because most solutions are enormously complex. Let's just take one which got completely folded up in the election, which is social care. Now, sooner or later, this issue is going to have to be addressed, and addressed right quick. However, what happened was an idea that should have probably been thought through for months, if not years, was dropped into the manifesto at the very last moment and presented as if it was a simple answer. Even the nuances of the policy got lost, which was that the intention was to, A, protect the elderly from having their house taken away from them during their lifetimes, and B, to ensure that £100,000 of their inheritance was safe, neither of which was remotely able to stand up to the two words, dementia tax. And that's, I think, a parable of the problem. Does the media have a role in that? Absolutely. I mean, you know, I have to say that I felt a bat's wig of shame when dementia tax began to, because I think it was a journalist that made it up. It usually is, and I thought it's not a dementia tax, whatever else it is. I mean, it had real defects. And then Theresa May went on and said there hasn't been a change, which is one of those great moments, a bit like when Gordon Brown said he hadn't, you know, it wasn't the polls that made him call off the election, when the electorate feels insulted and you know that there's going to be a real problem. But really, it was a classic instance of a huge policy dilemma that we are all facing. Well, I am certainly, I'm 49, so these things start to weigh on one's mind. And you really do see that is actually intrinsic to policy always, and will be so more and more, because what people, for example, I'll give you another example. When politicians talk about immigration, they're talking about future immigration. When voters talk about immigration, they're talking about past immigration. So they actually mean integration. Now, integration is a really, really interesting subject on which there are a whole variety of valid views. And Louise Casey produced a review which was more or less forgotten in 2 days. Meanwhile, everyone carried on throwing hand grenades at one another about tens of thousands and all this sort of stuff. We all know that immigration is going, whatever happens post-Brexit, immigration is going to carry on at a healthy lick because the economy requires it. I also think it's a cultural good, but let's just look at it in a purely economic term. You can't keep the NHS, social care, and many sectors of the economy going without immigration. Ergo, it's going to go on. Ergo, why are we having this bloody debate at all? But there is a really good debate to be had by people of calm approach and statesmanship about integration, and not just sort of, you know, racist slogans and Tommy Robinson turning up at every terrorist incident and saying what he says, which I'm not going to repeat. Actually conducting this in a very thoughtful way, but it gets swept aside. So complexity, yes, but it's the hardest. You're so right to raise it. This is the hardest thing to get across. On the question of creative presentation of data and partnering up with newspapers, I'm in favour of all that. I mean, I think you can't have enough data, and I'm also a great believer in campaigning and investigative journalism. I think that one of the sad things about the decline of the revenues that newspapers have is when I started back in the early 90s, there was still quite, most newspapers had an investigative unit, and most units, and most newspapers would take on three or four big campaigns a year. In partnership with one particular group or another, and they would, in the investigation, set teams of three or four people, you know, to work on data, often in partnership with particular groups. And the whole point was to be objective, of course, but not to be impartial, but to pursue a line. And I'd love to see more of that. The problem is that the resources available to print media now are simply not great enough to do that. But I dearly hope that as revenues move into the digital sphere, that there is more money available for this kind of thing, because it's so important. And the other question, which I have to say I don't have a pat answer at all, is the one about the level playing field between truth and post-truth in an emotional world. It's a very, very astute question, if you don't mind me saying so. And perhaps the answer is that it depends not so much on the level playing field, but how many people are on it and how angry they are about the people who are telling them lies. Because at the moment, the big problem is one of not passivity exactly, but disengagement, and a feeling that we are unconsulted and in many cases disenfranchised. And Grenfell was a dreadful symbol of so many things, but one of the most important, strategically looking forward, was that sense of people who are simply forgotten. This is not tolerable. I mean, no one of any party should regard that as tolerable. I felt Grenfell was a week in which I was very sorry that it became so partisan, because I felt it was a week in which it should, of course, blame should be apportioned, and if corporate manslaughter charges need to be laid, they should be laid, and people should lose their jobs. But I also think it's a time when as a polity, we should hang our heads in shame that this had come about.
Yeah, gentleman at the front. We'll just take a couple more, and the man at the back, then we'll stop and go out into the November-y weather.
But just on the question of complexity, and you used a very good example, because when I discuss, say, an issue like immigration, and I talk about how in the long term and on a national basis, it's beneficial. Statistical, empirical evidence shows that. But if I'm speaking to someone who's, say, 50 years old, and he grew up in Shadwell or Forest Gate, and he tells me about how things have changed for the worse, it's really hard to argue with him. And I think that's at the nub of it, that the somewhere people are looking at things on a local basis, whereas people, say, university graduates and people who have had the benefit of growing up, looking at things from a statistical data and empirical evidence point of view, take a broader view. Mm-hmm. And so there is silo thinking there, isn't
yeah.
there?
Okay, and the chap at the back there.
Thank you for the engaging session. I had three things, three questions. One was the post-truth, which is more akin to lying, but there's a whole new or a different level where you're talking in half-truths. Would the same methods to fight back or the same issues be available when we are talking, when we are sort of responding to half-truths, because they're technically not lies, but sort of take you in a completely a different zone, which is not really the actual truth. Second is when in terms of addressing the tech giants. In the process of regulations, what if some of the governments themselves get into the role of the tech giants, and then the regulator itself becomes a tech giant and starts controlling? And third, you're seeing the post-truth issues across the world now in different countries, but have you actually seen a concrete example of the fight back, which is effectively fought back, or at least a serious attempt on a fight back on post-truth?
Well, let me start off with that very interesting trio. You're right to imply that in some respects half-truths are more dangerous than lies, because a lie normally reveals itself sooner or later, but a half-truth can be insidious. So I would include half-truths as part of the mulch of post-truth, and I think that they're in some respects harder to combat, because they're Trojan horses, aren't they? They come in promising veracity, and then they deliver their payload of lie. And so that the methodology to undertake that is going to be much harder. And I, to be candid with you, I don't think people have really addressed it yet. But you raise a very important question. The tech giants. Well, I mean, you'll probably have gathered in my answers to questions about regulation that I am concerned that I don't want Facebook to become nationalized. I don't think there's much likelihood of that, but I certainly don't want these publishing platforms, which is effectively what they are, to become so stultified by regulation that their original point is lost. That's not my point at all. I'm interested in finding out more about the algorithms that drive them, and I think we should demand greater transparency. I mean, no agencies in the world other than intelligence agencies operate with the secrecy of the tech giants. It's quite incredible how little we know about them, even about the location of their hardware. You know, where is Google? Because it does actually, there is a place where a huge number of, starting with the original laptops that Sergey and his Larry Page put together, are linked together and now grow out into a kind of Doctor Who kind of inside of the TARDIS. Where this is, I don't know. But I have a feeling we should know, actually. I kind of feel that it's our right to know where these places are. Has there been a fight back against post-truth that has worked? I kind of feel that we are getting somewhere on science. And I think that I was very depressed about climate change, and I still am about the Trump position on it. But I think people have held their nerve in a way I thought perhaps they might not. And likewise on vaccination and science in general, actually. I think that particular war is not lost. Just to conclude with the gentleman's very interesting point about the silos of immigration and so on. You mentioned the Somewheres, which I take it to be a reference to my pal David Goodhart's book. It's a very interesting book, and David has had some interesting things to say, not all of which I agree with. My quibble with it is that I suppose he would have me down as the arch anywhere, right? Probably, doctor anywhere. And yet, you know, I live in Lewisham, and my friends and neighbours come from all ethnicities and backgrounds. I'm half Maltese, my children are half German. This is modern life, and what you actually find if you look at the statistics, he says quietly, is that fear of the foreign-born, or those with, more accurately, those with foreign origins, because most people who are described as foreigners by those who seem more exercised by immigration than having three meals a day, what they really mean is people who don't have a white skin, or people whose ancestors came from another country. They are actually talking about Britons. I don't buy this, and the statistics show that it's people who haven't had contact with those kinds of people that are most exercised by it. In other words, they want to protect their silo. Well, fine. As long as they're happy not to have a nurse at the end of their bed, as long as they're happy not to have people helping them in any number of the manufacturing jobs that are filled and construction jobs, and need I go on? You know, it's
I have very little sympathy for it, actually. Well, one has to tiptoe around this as if it's very interesting. What the right are always calling liberals snowflakes. Have you ever, if you're on Twitter, have you ever had a real go at someone on the right? It takes about two goes before they burst into tears. When you go home tonight, enjoy yourself. just see who's the real snowflake. I think it's time. No, I really do. I think it's time to stand up to it. I'm fed up with hearing about how wicked and evil and terrible and how foreigners are and how it's ruined Britain. And what a load of old crap. Britain has always been a fabulously pluralistic place. Read Peter Ackroyd's History of London, you know, and many other books like it, to realise that this is a complete myth of a... So it's always the 50s, isn't it? The homogenous 1950s, in which apparently everyone, you know, rode bikes. I don't think they did, actually. Anyway, on that irrelevant note, thank you very much.
Okay, very good.
Matthew's going to slip out because there's a table out there covered in books, and if you'd like to buy one, do, and he'll sign it, no doubt. I just say, we had an event here with David Goodhart on his book, so, you know, balancing it up over time. We've got different views expressed here. All I just say about this evening is, this is a subject that's topical, multi-level, very politically important at the time in which we live, and a chameleon-like subject, capable of moving quickly, changing its colour, reacting, a very interesting sort of topic for our time. So, well, I'd end with two things. One is, truth clearly has a purpose. We all base our lives on it most of the time, whatever has been said. The other thing, I was listening to the radio the other day where Hilary Mantel was asked by an interviewer whether she was guilty of, as it were, inventing history, Tudor history, by writing novels that became the people's understanding of Tudor history above historians' view of history. So it's interesting to think perhaps you can, I'm not saying she did, but, you know, invent the truth in the past as well as now. Anyway, on that, I'd like to thank you all for coming. Great evening. Thank you very much.